tell me about this project. Did you guys hatch this idea on Mount McKinley, or where did it come from?
I've been thinking about it since I came here, really.
You know,
but looking at maps. But I didn't really know I was ever going to get this done. It took getting together with Eric 20 years ago or something. Him and I talked about it. Something or 15.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably 20 years ago.
But looking at maps is one thing. I mean, anybody who's looked at a map and thought, oh, it looks like it. I could walk from here. It looks like I could walk from Lake Saloya to Slocum Arm easy. And then you step on shore, and it's like, oh, my God. There's terrain. There's immense brush, blowdown. There's chest-deep streams. There's all this stuff that the map just doesn't reveal. Eric, you're nodding very knowingly.
There's weather, too.
Yeah.
There's weather, which just has just a tremendous impact on how quickly you can move and when you can move. And that's hard to plan for here.
So what is the overall route? If you were to, publish this, you would say start where and end where?
Start at the northernmost tip of Baranof, which is right next to Astoya Island, and walk to the southernmost tip, which is Cape Omni, right next to Port Alexander.
And how long is it going to take?
We got 32 days into it now.
Okay.
Over 6 years.
I thought you were going to say something much longer, but 32 days.
32 days, yeah.
32 travel days?
32 yes. Travel days. Well, actually, no. We had
32
one day.
Days total.
We had one day we actually couldn't move because we were in a bad weather, bad storm. So really, we only had 31 days of moving.
Okay.
Like full days, though, like 16-hour days.
So, yeah. Dan, you've been thinking about it 20 years. When did you involve Eric?
Wow, we talked about it not long after Eric came to town, I think. What year was that?
I got here in 97, and we started talking about the possibility. We probably started talking about it when we were crossing the island east-west. Not long after I got here, Dan and I walked over to Baranof Warm Springs and started doing some hiking and exploring together, and we probably started talking about it then.
Plus we did, Denali and all this, and we kind of had a lot of time to talk about it. It was a major undertaking just to get this figured out. I thought originally we'd do it in one push, but now that I see what we went through, I don't know.
Well, a couple of college kids last summer were dropped off, I guess, near Astoya Island with the intention of doing it in one summer. Did you have to bite your tongue?
Yeah, deal? Definitely. Yeah, because we didn't finish the trip yet.
Oh.
we had that section to do. And I'm not saying that it can't be done faster. We didn't do it for speed. We did it for the experience. And these guys did it for speed. But the thing is you have to account for weather. And you might think you can do it in 10 days. That's what they thought. You'd have to have 10 perfect days. And then I still doubt you could do it.
And you need 10 perfect days because a lot of this happens above tree line.
Exactly.
Yes, you have to be able to navigate some of the valleys and the rivers, and if it's pouring rain or if it's snowing and there's avalanches, some of the snow fields are more dangerous, and so it's not just fog and wind, and it's all the different weather events. We could do it more efficiently if we weren't doing pickups and drop-offs, so we had to sometimes hike down. Or hike down to water or hike to a lake to where we could get picked up or dropped off. But if you did it in one push, even if you had perfect weather, I think it would take, I don't even think you could do it in 10 days. I think it would be more like 15 or 20.
So knowing what you know now, would you ever try it again in one push? Or would you ever suggest to somebody that they try it again in one push and that they...
We talked about it. Now we kind of established a route, if people follow that, there's variations off our route, so we already got that figured out. If people watch that, they could definitely trim some time off it. And as far as me doing that again in one push, I say not for me. I might do other little sections that we've seen that we'd want to do, but I don't think I would. I want to do like Chichagof and Admiralty first.
Okay. Yeah, you're already sort of thinking about the next
Yeah.
Epic hike. I heard an anecdotal story. Maybe it was just anecdote. Maybe it's one of those things everybody, you know, you guys know, people talk about you behind your backs about Eric and Dan and your crazy excesses. But I heard that you miscalculated a food drop out of Salmon Lake one time and you were trying to get somewhere and you had to hike for a couple of days. Just
that was our first, leg of the journey. And when we started, we actually did think we were going to do it fast. So we decided to cut weight. Eric, you can kind of, you remember exactly what we cut on food and all. So you might as well.
Yeah, we were going to walk from the end of Silver Bay to Whale Bay. And we thought that it was going to take us 3 days. And so we figured we'd go just a little bit light and bring 2.5 days of food. And then when we got to Salmon Lake Cabin after walking from Silver Bay to Salmon Lake, we still felt our packs felt a little bit heavy. And so we figured we'd jettison a little bit more food and we'd leave it at the Salmon Lake Cabin for some visitors. It ended up taking us 6 days to get to Whale Bay because of some weather. We had massive rain and weren't able to stay up high and had to do a lot of bushwhacking through some of the valleys, through Benjamin Valley and around Politovsky Lake and around No Name Lake. And took a lot longer, and so that was our first experience with things don't always go as you plan when you're walking on Bear Enough Island.
We lost 12 pounds each on that trip.
And what was the rationing scheme like?
We started rationing on the third day. Mm-hmm. We had to just start cutting back, and we weren't exactly sure how long it still was going to take us because we were looking ahead, going, "Hey, that we might get there in 2 days." Well, 2 days come and go. So
we were splitting like one packet of oatmeal between the two of us for breakfast, and you know, lunch might have been split a half packet of hot chocolate, and you know, have a split a power bar for dinner.
Yeah, it was rough.
Were you just sucking on the hot chocolate, or did you actually make a cup of hot chocolate?
We made a cup of hot chocolate. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the image I had in my mind was you like just pouring it into your mouth and sort of brewing it on your
tongue. No. We had a little stove.
Yeah, we had a little pocket rocket stove that actually has served us really well, super light. And so we had the stove. We just didn't have anything to cook on it.
The very last day, though, we got up to the ridgeline to head to Abos Lake. And what did we have for breakfast? What did we do? We split a hot chocolate.
Yeah, I think that's all we had.
Yeah, we split a hot chocolate. That's what we had all day. And it was a rainstorm wind. And it was that year we had massive snow, so we had to cross some pretty gnarly ridges to get there, and we were in whiteout a lot. We did a lot of circles, so we were doing straight lines. But we made it. When we got to the cabin, we had massive food there, and we started chowing.
So you had a food drop waiting.
Yeah.
Was that the most anxious moment of this expedition?
I would say certainly not. That was the first week in, and there's been many, many more.
Talked about that on the last trip. We had like three times that were kind of really low moments on the trip. We had one year, it was our third year, and we were coming down a valley into Big Branch. It's like the longest valley on the island. And we left, and it was raining like crazy here. And the valley down there was flooding. Just the rivers were flooding into the brush and everything like that. We had to cross this river late at night, and Eric kept wanting to cross this one spot. It looked like the only place, but I didn't like it. We'd go out halfway, we'd come back. We'd go out halfway, we'd come back. And then it was like, we got to do it. So we locked arms and crossed the river. And as we're crossing, I started feeling my legs kind of picking up off the bottom. The next thing I know, Eric peeled off of me, and I saw his red rain jacket go down the river. As I was already swimming for the cut bank on the side of the river, I grabbed on a bunch of roots, and I'm underneath this dirt pile with roots and everything, with my pack on, trying to pull myself up the bank. And I worked my way up the roots onto the top of this dirt clump, and I finally looked down to see if Eric's all right. And about 50 feet downriver, just before this log jam, Eric's climbing up out. So it was, and this was like 10 o'clock at night. And it was totally soaked and it's raining hard. And we just got together and said, okay, let's go. Just to keep moving. And we went for another hour till camp.
Well, you had to get dried off.
We had to get warm, and really the only way to get warm is to move. And so we had to get warm, and there was no place to stop there. So we moved for about another hour until we found a spot under some big trees. And we've definitely learned to kind of use the resources and find big trees and make a fire. And when you're going for days, particularly when it's raining, you really do need to dry out your socks and your feet and your shoes if possible, or else your feet really suffer and you can't keep going. And so we've gotten good at making big fires, even in the pouring rain, finding places to do it and finding dry timber and getting a fire going. You know, sometimes it takes us a couple hours of just collecting, you know, little bits. If it's been raining for a week, it takes a while to find dry stuff up under rocks and up under logs. But we can get one going, and then once it gets going, you can start adding stuff on, and we just make a huge bonfire and dry everything out.
We had a few nights, though, that we'd pull in the camp, no fire, just get in. And we always had some dry gear. The key is to have a plastic bag with something, your sleeping bag, and some insulated underwear. That's your, like, night gear. That's like the sacred pack. You cannot get that wet. And so we have something dry to get into. So set up the tent, and you can get into something dry. You take all your clothes off that's soaked, and you just flop them down on the ground with a big foam.
Outside the tent.
Outside the tent. And then in the morning, you got to put that stuff back on, because you don't have any dry clothes. So you that's how you pack up in the morning, is get your stuff on and just get moving, because it's freezing.
So those are the lows. What about the highs?
I would say the highs are just, traversing on some of these amazing alpine ridges, you know, in the evening or early morning when the light is just incredible. Mm. Some of these unexplored alpine lakes and valleys that very few, if any, people have been to. There's definitely some, you know, gems on Baranof Island that I don't think many people have ever discovered. And those are definitely the high points, is finding
some
those
of the
areas.
Giant trees we've seen some really big trees, big cedars, big spruces, just knowing that we're in places that probably no one's ever been before. I know we were in many, many places like that. It's a good feeling when you can look out and know that there's no one around you, too. Pretty nice.
And just being able to really explore. I mean, I think there's less and less places in the world today to really explore. And so that's part of the neat thing about being the first to find that route. It takes a lot of time to find the route. There were sometimes you'd walk half a day and then find you couldn't come down off a ridge and have to turn around and walk back. And so that's part of the reason it took as long as it did, is because we weren't following anyone else's path. And so it takes a lot of time to navigate and explore, and that's part of the adventure.
Quite a few years ago, Dan, you penciled a route for me across Baranof Island.
Okay.
You know, from Medviji to Baranof, okay. Warm Springs. And you drew the line across, you know, up Mount Bassi and over the ice field there. And nothing, you know, to the uninitiated person, I would say nothing about that pencil line suggested any kind of route whatsoever. I mean, it didn't look, wasn't calling to me as a route.
Right.
At all. I mean, how do you look at a topo map and decide what's a route and what's absolute,
you know,
foolishness?
It's kind of difficult because those lines are 100-foot lines, and a lot of stuff can happen in 100 feet. I mean, think about, even if it's 30 feet, there could be a cliff that stops you. So there's a lot that can happen there. You just got to read into the maps and try to take a good idea if it's possible. You can see if the lines are super close together. You're probably not going to be able to do that. Sometimes you can, though. Sometimes you get super surprised. We went up some steep, steep stuff that you look at the map and it looks like a cliff. But we find these fingers of trees that climb up onto these ridges. So you wouldn't think you could do it, but you can. But a lot of times it happens the other way, where you think, oh, this will be easy. And you get there and there's this big cliff. Oh, no, we got to go someplace else. It just takes a while to figure out the map, you know, by reading it enough.
And I think a huge part of it is like following game wisdom.
Yeah.
I mean, we've learned to follow the animal trails, because if you're on a really steep, something that looks like a cliff and you're looking down, you can't quite see the bottom, but there's a goat trail or a bear trail or a deer trail going down it. You know, we know that they're probably not going to go down it if there's no way down. And so we've also learned that even if it looks good and there's no game trail to be found, to exercise extreme caution, because there's probably a reason the game aren't going that way. We like to follow deer trails. I'd say goat and bear trails are doable, but they're not nearly as fun, because goats and bear can scramble up or down some pretty incredible terrain.
And sometimes bear trails end up being tunnels through the brush. Mm-hmm. We've crawled through those in the dark. I remember sticking my hand in a pile of fresh bear crap and just turning around to Eric and saying, bear crap. And we were in this brushy tunnel in the back of Whale Bay. And it was a kind of a scary thing with our headlamps on at night. Eric almost went off a cliff that night trying to go down, and we couldn't see. That was a phenomenal night, though. Mm-hmm. We make it back to the, we have these kayaks stashed. We get back into the Whale Bay, and they're inflatable kayaks. When we get there, and we got to paddle back to the boat, which is about 2 hours away. Pitch black. Stars are out. It's beautiful. Have the inflatable kayaks. We forgot our life jackets. So it's like, crap. I think maybe we can camp here. Well, all of a sudden, a bear comes in and starts growling at us. We chase that thing off. And we sit there and still contemplate whether we're going to camp there, and the bear comes back in again. And it's like, we got to get out of here. So we jump into the kayaks in the pitch black at Whale Bay and start paddling. And the phosphorescence in the water that night was better than I've ever seen in my life. And we paddled, and the glow off of the kayaks was awesome. And it was in the fall, September, and the pink salmon were coming in. And you'd paddle across a school of pink salmon, and it'd be like a lightning storm in the water. It was so incredible. We paddled for 2 hours in that. It was fantastic. Dead tired, because we had like a 16-hour day plus the paddling. But wow, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that with the fish and the phosphorescence. I've seen the phosphorescence off your boat and off your paddle, or even when you're swimming. But seeing the fish moving and being able to watch the fish's movement in the phosphorescence was just an amazing, kind of eerie in the beginning. At first, it was a little bit scary, and then as we got used to it, it was really cool to watch.
So you really were just stitching together chunks of route, because you had taken your boat in and then paddled ashore and then left, stashed your kayaks, and then did a section of the route and then come back.
Yeah, that was I think that was your number five. We did that one. And the only reason we did the Whale Bay one is because our first year we went to Avos, and then the next year we started on the other side of Whale Bay. So we felt like we have to connect the dots. So we went back and connected the dots. So we took my boat down there, and we did that.
Would you ever consider doing this trip like with a pack raft and doing it lake to lake rather than ridge to ridge?
It's not as appealing. I really like being up in the Alpine and being in the mountains. There certainly are some mountain lakes that are fun to cross, but there's not enough lakes and rivers when traveling north-south, in my opinion, to make it worth carrying a pack raft the whole way. It's been done where someone went from Sitka to Port Alexander with a pack raft, but they did probably 75% of it paddling along the coast. And I think that's a really neat adventure, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, we wanted to keep it land-based, and so we wanted to make a route, and that's how that happened.
Man, do you think people can follow your route?
I think now, yeah, we have a pretty good GPS marks all the way along. So if somebody wants to do it, it'd definitely be worth talking to us, because we could tell them how to make it better. It's almost the only way to go staying high, but there are variations that people could do that would be better.
Yeah, we learned along the way. I mean, sometimes we would come down something and look back and see an alternate ridge and say, oh, that actually probably would have been a little bit better. And so we've talked about that too, actually, is going back and see, and there's questions that we have about, well, I wonder if we had gone on that ridge, if it would have been a little bit faster or a little bit more efficient. And so we've talked about going and duplicating small sections to try and come up with the most efficient route. And so I think we still might do that. We might still go explore areas and see if we can shave a day off here and a day off there. Some parts of the route are extremely challenging, and so if someone is trying to duplicate it, it's certainly possible. We did it, but it's very challenging. You have to be able to put up with some discomfort
And along the way. Watch out for bears
and be persistent. I think persistence. I mean, I think that's and Dan's, I think, probably one of the only people I could have done this with, because neither one of us ever wants to give up. And so there's been lots and lots of times where I think many people would give up, and Dan doesn't give up. And I think he knows the same thing about me.
I almost
me.
Wanted to cry this year once.
Oh. Yeah? Why?
Oh, my gosh. We are on this ridge trying to get to Sitka, and it snowed. It's in June, and it's snowing. And we had a whiteout, and we had to get around this peak. And we were looking at the map, and the lines are close together. So we thought, maybe we can do this, but we have to see it. So we spent the day on this ledge. We made a moss bed for the tent to sit on. It was a pretty spectacular campsite. But the next day, it was still white out. We couldn't see anything. And we decided to drop into the valley. We looked at it and went, let's drop into the valley. We could come into Nakwasina and work our way from there. But the bottom of the valley on the map looked like maybe we could get through there. So let's give it a shot. We spent all day busting the brush. And then at 9 o'clock at night, we're 800 feet above a raging river in these winter grounds of mountain goats and no place to go except back. And it's raining like crazy and we're soaked. It was kind of a real hard moment to deal with. It was like, oh man, we got to go all the way back to where we were. So we walked back about an hour and set up camp and dried our stuff out till about 3 a.m. And then the next day we got going, we found a way out of the valley. But wow, that was a really hard time. Both of us. You don't talk much. And for that whole hour we walked, it was no talking. We're just like, I think I'll just keep this to myself right now.
When you're doing something with a partner who kind of shares your sense of mission, I mean, they're not just along for the ride. They're not just there to kind of drain you and, you know, tap your knowledge, but you're there to sort of, the two of you kind of create, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts feeling. You do get into a situation where you become kind of a collective mind, and you can retreat to your own thoughts, but you're still working as a team. You realize you get to a point where you can't go any farther. You have to go back and regroup, and that must happen a lot.
Yeah, it happens constantly, and there's always, you know, the team is only moving as fast as the weakest link, and so there's always times where different, you know, in the group, different people need more help or are at a low point, and the other person just takes up the slack, and so there's times where I'm moving a little bit slower, and Dan takes up the slack, and vice versa, and there's constantly. The same thing happens with judgment when you're deciding on a route and you come to an area that looks pretty sketchy or steep and you're trying to decide if it's safe or not. And it really works. We found that it works well bouncing it back and forth off each other. And usually if we both decide to go, it's right. It's worked out. And if we're both putting the danger button on, then we don't, but you know.
Yeah. And over time, you know, over the 30-some years I've been here and 20-something Eric's been here, you learn different things. I mean, what you can do and what's really sketchy. Do you feel like, have you done that before? And so there'd be things that I've done that Eric hasn't done. So we'd get to a place and then I would do it and he wouldn't feel comfortable. And then we'd get to other places he'd feel comfortable and I wouldn't. But we'd kind of egg each other on and make it through these places.
What was the plan B if somebody was seriously injured or, you know, you looked down and you didn't see Eric on that flooded
stream? We don't talk about that.
No? No plan B?
No, we have a beacon. We have a NEPIRB beacon that we can set off and get help. You know, we carry, you know, a lot of gear. We carry safety gear. We carry a rope. We have ice axes. And it's one of the reasons we can't go ultralight because of the terrain that we're on. But we have a pretty extensive first aid kit, and we have, you know, we always keep warm clothes and a sleeping bag, and it's one of the reasons we have a tent, not a tarp, and so we feel like we've gotten our kit down to a minimum, but definitely part of the kit is safety, and we're not making choices that put our lives in jeopardy in general. I mean, we're, you know, if we think something is sketchy, and you know, we've got like a gauge where, you know, okay, if we slip or we mess up here, we can get hurt, but we're not going to die. And so
that's how we define sketching.
Yeah. So,
it's you like, know, if you we can get hurt here, but you probably won't die. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and if it's, 10 o'clock at night and we've been going all day and it looks like it's the only route off that mountain, then we might push it a little bit, you know? But if it looks like, you know, we could die if this doesn't work out, then we don't do it, obviously.
We've never done any of those.
No, we don't make that choice. It's not worth it. We both have families and so no.
Well, some people would say that's a pretty crazy threshold, but I hear you. I mean, I understand that you have to have a bar, and as long as your bar is the same, then that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's certainly potential, and you both know that, for moving over this kind of country to get hurt. Remarkably, there's never been a sprained ankle. There's never been a significant injury that stopped us. And I think when you're walking around in the woods and navigating, you do think about that, and you step carefully, and you're not being reckless, because when you're in, you know, 4 days into the center of the island and it's white out, even if you set your EPIRB off, someone might not be able to come get you right away. And so I think you're thinking about that, and that also factors into your judgment. You really can't be reckless, because if you do get hurt, eventually someone is going to be able to come find you, but it might take days. And so, you know, I think a lot of this sounds real high risk and real high-end adventure, but we are being really pretty careful and calculated with what we're doing.
The one risk you can't calculate for is bears. What are they going to do? You know, you run it. We're following bear trails all the time, and we're seeing them all the time, but you never know. You know, and my hearing really stinks, so I got to have Eric along to hear things. Yeah, he's got charged one year by a really big one, and it wasn't scary at the time, but after it was over with, my heart was racing. We thought we were going to get plowed over for sure.
So he wasn't serious.
He was serious, yes, he was.
How close?
Well, about 30 feet in front of Eric. We were walking through the woods down into Port Lucie, and the bear jumped up out of the brush but ran the other direction, straight in front of us. Ran about 50 feet, turned around, and started heading straight at us. Full bore, ears back, hair up, and it's a big boar. It's a very big bear. So we both got our cans out, and we're holding them, and we're screaming at this bear, screaming. It's coming through the berry bushes fast. And we talked about it many times, about when are we going to spray, you know. So we're waiting for this time. And as soon as it comes out of the bushes, which is going to be about 25, 30 feet from us, we're ready to spray. This bear comes out of the bushes and does a hard left turn and heads off to the left side. And then it stood up on its hind legs, right, and then ran off.
Yeah, we were just about ready. I mean, It probably couldn't have been any closer. The bear was actually, I think, sleeping, and I was in the front, and it was up under a spruce as we came out on the beach, and I think it was asleep. And if I had gone, you know, a few more yards, I would have stepped on it, and it just jumped up, and we surprised it, and it started running, and then I think it figured, well, what am I running from? I'm the biggest guy around here, and it turned around. But yeah, there was really no time to be scared. It happened too quick, but. But afterwards, and after it charged away, and we just looked at each other, you know, then we realized.
I've been in sort of similar circumstances, and it's like, okay, Bear, you made your point. You made your point very well.
Exactly. No doubt about it.
You established yourself here as the baddest thing.
No doubt about that.
And I think that maybe has changed some things, because the last two trips we've taken, the last 2 years, we carried a pistol with us. And so before that, we just really carried bear spray. But, you know, and it would have, if you talked with me, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I probably would have argued pretty strongly that really a pistol isn't needed. But I think maybe being charged and might change your mind a little bit. It seems like it's changed ours, evidently, because now, you know, one of us carries a pistol.
And then again, you know, I always think if I had a gun on that one and I shot, I would have probably shot at that bear. It was that, I mean, it was right there. So the bear lived. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know what would have happened.
So Dan, how's the hip?
Oh, the hip's great. So this is my third year on my fake hip.
Yeah.
And I've done 3 years of this trip already. It's doing fantastic. I'm not hurting. First couple of years, I was kind of limping through it. But now it's so far so good. Knock on wood.
Do you make him do therapy at the end of the day?
He did a lot of therapy before, after he got his hip replaced. He certainly did a lot of therapy in preparation. And,
right.
Yeah, so I had it replaced, and then 7 months later, I went on the trip. So it's fantastic. I'm super happy with it.
How old are you, Dan?
Me, I'm 56.
Oh, yeah. How about you?
I'm 48.
So, and the next adventure, are you got it lined up?
Well, we talk about Chichagof as the next one. I think that's probably what we'll do, I'm thinking. I don't know when we'll do that, though. We didn't talk about taking a year off or going or not or anything yet.
Well,
we're just happy to be done with this one.
Yeah. I want to say Chichagof is a lot friendlier island. That's why I like going there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, more glaciated, less intimidating. You know, Baranof Island, you look at Gavin Hill. We live here in Sitka under Gavin Hill, and you think it's rolling, forested, alpine ridges, but it's really impressive, some of the most impressive terrain anywhere, don't you think?
You pass Whale Bay on the south end, it changes again, and it's way more cliffy. I think the glaciers might have retreated from there later or whatever, but it's really cliffy down there. So in places up here, you have more trees down there. It's sometimes hard to get to the ridge.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most rugged places in the world. I mean, there's many times being in the center of the island and looking out over the peaks that it looks like the Alps or it looks like Patagonia. You don't really get a true impression standing here in town and looking up. You know, it takes a couple days, at least a day of walking in before you really get a picture of what the island has to offer.
Yeah, that first hike up Picnic Rock for people is so eye-opening. When you can see a little bit of the island's backbone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, I had no idea. Unless you're flying in on a clear day and the pilot takes you over,
right.
You know, from Ketchikan, takes you over PA. And
it's like jagged teeth.
Yeah.
The island is pretty crazy.
And it's a pretty cool feeling just being, you know, going up to Picnic Rock or Bear Mountain now and standing up on the peak and looking north and looking south at just these jagged peaks that go on almost pretty much as far as you can see, and just thinking that, you know, we've walked all that now. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty fun. It's just a really neat adventure.
How many miles in all?
Well, we've been talking about that. It's, you know, it's 32 days of walking. It's 100 miles in a perfect straight line north-south. But, you know, when we do different calculations, we usually walk, you know, 15 to 18 hours a day. And we've got a spot that sends out little breadcrumbs so we can see, you know, we're going left and right and up and down and around cliffs and around tree falls. And so we're walking constantly. We hardly ever stop. We kind of eat on the move. And so, you know, even if we only walk about a mile and a half an hour, and I think we probably walk a little bit more than that, but if we walked a mile and a half an hour, that comes out to be just under 600 miles. So I think it's probably somewhere between 500 and 700 miles.
That's about the best we could come up with anyway.
Amazing. All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks, Robert.
Thanks.